From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. It's Here and Now. Jeremy is off today. And in a lengthy press conference today from Orlando, FBI officials said they will not be releasing the audio of the Pulse nightclub shooter's 911 calls out of respect for his victims and their families. They did, however, release some partial transcripts.
Yeah, maybe too raw, and maybe we're all spared hearing that audio, at least for now. So we're following news from Orlando and from the campaign trail. Corey Lewandowski, he of the alleged bruise-inducing grip, is out as Donald Trump's campaign manager. You might remember when reporter Michelle Fields, then with Breitbart, said Lewandowski grabbed her when she tried to interview Donald Trump. So now Corey is gone. Hillary Clinton added Barack Obama's top financial advisor to her team. And the Senate considers four gun safety bills that are also cloaked in politics. Let's check in on a Monday with Domenico Montanaro, NPR's lead politics editor. He joins us now from Washington. And Domenico, start with Corey Lewandowski fired.
Yeah, I mean, Corey Lewandowski is out at the campaign. Sarah McCammon here who's out on the trail for us and following the Trump campaign has confirmed those details. And there's lots of backbiting and infighting within the campaign. It was framed, Sarah says, as a battle with Paul Manafort, who is running the D.C. side of things and was elevated above Lewandowski, and that they've had a tense relationship for months. Trump is actually holding a conference call with his inner circle of advisors and staff, and there's potentially a role that Donald Trump's daughter has played in this as well, where she has been a pretty strong advocate of her father and decided at this point that it was time for Lewandowski to go and was able to finally convince her father to do just that.
Right. Well, and I wonder, Domenico, how much it has to do with the past week. Donald Trump's first response, his critics say, to the Orlando shootings was to congratulate himself on predicting that there would be violence. He doubled down last week on banning Muslims from this country, widened it to banning immigrants from areas that might have terrorists. Is there a sense that it was a bad week and he needed to make a change?
Well, it's not just a bad week. It's been a bad month for Donald Trump. This has been a terrible June for Donald Trump. You've seen some of that unity that Republicans seem to have completely evaporate and fall apart. You've had leaders in Congress on the Republican side say that they no longer can support Donald Trump or that he's at an inflection point. It all kind of started with the veterans fundraiser that he had held some months ago and the Washington Post reporting that Trump had not given the $1 million that he'd said he had. He had to hold that press conference on it to refute those facts. Then we wound up with the Trump University fraud lawsuit where the documents were unveiled and revealed that showed these tough sales tactics that Trump University had used, and that the judge in that case, presiding over that case, you had Donald Trump saying that the person was biased because of their Mexican heritage. Mm-hmm. And you've seen all of that take a huge toll on Trump's poll numbers. He's down an average of 6 points to Hillary Clinton, below 40% in the past month. He's not spending any money on advertising, which is really remarkable.
None.
Hillary Clinton.
Yeah.
Zero at this point. Hillary Clinton is up with $23.5 million in ads in eight key swing states. Trump and allies, nobody spending anything to support Trump. A huge switch from 2012 when Barack Obama and allies had a narrow advantage over Mitt Romney. They were already both sides spending more than $80 million. At this point, Donald Trump up with nothing. And, you know, one poll number I would point to is really fascinating to me. CBS New York Times had this poll out where they said 41% of people actually thought Hillary Clinton, what she had done with her email server was illegal. Donald Trump was only getting 37% of all those folks against Hillary Clinton. So he was underperforming what should be his floor. He wasn't even getting all of the people who thought Hillary Clinton's server was illegal.
We'll talk a little bit about guns because they were so much a part of the campaign last week. And Donald Trump made some comments that people interpreted as his believing that people on the terror watch list maybe shouldn't be able to buy guns. He was going to meet with the NRA. People were thinking maybe he might shift the NRA. Instead, he changed his position. Here he is when he said if people in the club had guns strapped to them when the shooters started shooting, it would have been a good thing.
And one of the people in that room happened to have it and goes boom, boom. You know what? That would have been a beautiful, beautiful sight, folks.
He's walked that back. Today he tweeted, obviously he was not talking about people in the room, which he sounded like he was. He was talking about additional guards or employees. Is this because an NRA spokesman said, no, we don't agree that people should be drinking and carrying firearms?
Yeah, that's, again, the NRA's position on this, where Donald Trump, again, on a conservative issue, doesn't seem to be in line or understanding what the policy is. And I think it comes directly from Wayne LaPierre going out and saying that guns and alcohol don't mix.
Yeah.
So I think that's exactly what you're seeing. And on legislation on the floor, it's very difficult to see what will get passed. But Democrats are certainly more on offense now than we've seen them in past years. But I wouldn't expect huge legislation to wind up getting passed. They are looking at the no-fly list and whether or not you should allow folks with guns or to be able to purchase guns who are on the no-fly list.
Yeah, it may not pass, but as you say, a Democratic filibuster at least forced a vote. NPR lead politics editor Domenico Montanaro, thank you as always.
You're welcome.
And another one of the central themes of Trump's campaign has been his call to build a bigger wall at the Mexican border. Even as that idea is debated, large numbers of refugees from Central America are heading to the United States again, continuing a trend that could rival 2014, a year that saw tens of thousands of migrants enter the U.S. from Mexico. Many, of course, were children sent alone on the long journey. Michel Marisco from the Fronteras desk at KJZZ reports on how authorities are managing the latest flow of migrants.
Yuma County Sheriff Captain Eben Bratcher revs his four-wheel drive truck through the soft sands along the Mexican border. It's a region where migrant traffic had dropped to a lull as quiet as the haunting desert dunes, but now is picking up again. The Yuma sector is a 126-mile stretch of U.S.-Mexico border that evolved from rusting strands of barbed wire sprawling over white sand dunes into a feat of complicated engineering. It now ranges from steel barriers along the Colorado River, where Mexico, Arizona, and California meet, to a miles-long cage of tightly woven screen monitored by enormous lights and cameras, then a high wall that runs east of Yuma out into the desert, all at a cost of $6.5 million per mile. Yet crossings persist, the tales of those attempts scattered in the northbound footprints, the crawl spaces dug beneath the massive security screens, the cracked water bottles and torn garments of clothing left to bake in the sun, and a splintered wooden ladder.
We're driving along. You spotted what appears to be a homemade ladder, suspiciously about as long as the fence is high.
The buildup led to a 90% drop in unauthorized crossings of Mexican nationals, but there's been a noticeable uptick with Central Americans trying to cross the border and then turning themselves over to U.S. Customs and Border Protection, ultimately asking the U.S. for asylum.
What the word is now is that if you come across and claim asylum or seek asylum, turn yourself in. Give yourself up to the first border patrolman that you see, and then here you are.
In 2014, Central Americans flooded the U.S., mostly at the Texas border, and by May 1 that year, some 36,000 lone children were among them. The number dropped by half last year, but this year is already back to 2014 levels, with nearly 33,000 children taken into custody by CBP. The Yuma sector here in Arizona has seen its own spike. By May 2014, 216 kids arrived here alone. By May 1 of this year, that number reached 1,700. Officials with CBP declined to be interviewed for the story. They attribute the growth in the number of new migrants to seasonal trends. In February, CBP Commissioner Gil Kerlikowske asked the House Appropriations Committee for up to $35 million to manage an expected 75,000 children at the border.
We remain concerned about seasonal increases later this year and in fiscal year 2017. The budget request 12.
Two Immigration and Customs Enforcement agents help a pair of women with children off a government van and into a church in Yuma, Arizona. Marisol asked that we not use her full name because she feared for her life. She says she fled Honduras in April after her two uncles were murdered. She followed a route she was told about that brought her to Yuma. Marisol told me she tied her four-year-old son to her back in a makeshift sling, then climbed over the first of 12-foot-high security screens, dropped into the U.S., and surrendered to Border Patrol. Melanie Nelson is with Yuma County Interfaith. She says about 25 mothers are now dropped off at her shelter every week.
If they've gotten here, they've made it. This is the easiest part of the trip, where there are bus drivers that are there to protect them, much more so on their road to their families than at any other time on their trip.
Beatriz Escalante says she hitchhiked here from Guatemala. She also surrendered after climbing the wall.
Por mi niño, porque que allá no hay trabajo para mí.
Escalante says she did it for her child because there's no work in Guatemala. For now, she has a Greyhound bus ticket and an immigration court date ahead of her in Chicago. She sits in the grass by a water fountain with her toddler in one arm and waits. For Here and Now, I'm Michel Marisco, reporting from Yuma, Arizona.
And Michel's story came to us from the Fronteras Desk. It's a public radio collaboration that focuses on the border, immigration, and changing demographics. Tomorrow, we'll look at a U.S. program that pays Mexico to manage its border with Guatemala in hopes of keeping migrants from reaching the United States. It's Here and Now.
Research at the National Science Foundation's Amundsen-Scott Research Station at the South Pole is dangerous, made more so because if something happens, it is difficult, even impossible, to get out. You may remember Dr. Jerry Lynn Nielsen. In 2009, she had to give herself a biopsy, then treat her own breast cancer for months until the winter passed and it was safe for a plane to evacuate her. In 2011, a manager had a stroke but had to stay for 2 months. Well, now another crew member is ill and a dangerous rescue mission is underway. Kelly Faulkner is director of the Division of Polar Programs at the National Science Foundation. And Kelly, we know for privacy reasons you're not revealing the crew member or their illness, but it's got to be serious. You've hired 2 planes to do this rescue. So what kind of planes and how hard is it to get to the South Pole?
At this time of year, it's pretty difficult to get to the South Pole. You've got 24 hours of darkness and it's extremely cold. And you do have weather systems moving through. So there are only few aircraft in the world that can actually conduct this mission. So we have hired Twin Otter aircraft. They're operated out of Canada, and they've made their way down through South America. In fact, just this morning, early, they took off from Punta Arenas in South America and Chile to go to the British Antarctic Survey Station, Rothera. And from there, one of the planes will go to South Pole to conduct the rescue.
And by the way, from Rothera, it's 1,500 miles to the South Pole. It just reminds us how extraordinarily removed the South Pole is.
Well, you can envision that the area of the Antarctic continent is 1.5 times that of the U.S., and then realize that there are very, very few people on it. Right now, at South Pole Station, there are 48 people in place.
Yeah, and one of them very sick. Now, first of all, these are prop planes. Why 2 of them, and why is one standing back?
We always have to build in a contingency. This is sort of building in our own search and rescue capability to have 2 planes go together.
Yeah. And what happens? Like, what's the chain of events when someone gets sick? I mean, as I said, there's privacy issues around this current emergency situation, but what, I mean, you have communication with them. What happens?
Well, first of all, we hope that people don't develop such illnesses, and right. We actually put them through a pretty rigorous health screening before they go, but you can't predict everything. What we have in place at the South Pole is a small clinic. We do have a physician who is there through the winter as a physician assistant as well. They have the capability of talking to medical expertise stateside here. So for us right now, that's the University of Texas Medical Branch, and they have access to a full staff of all kinds of expertise. So what happens when someone gets sick is they'll go to the clinic, and the doctor there will tend to them. And then depending on the situation, we'll consult with other experts and treat to the extent that they are capable of treating there. They get to the point where it's a very serious situation. We will be called in. We have our own chief medical officer on staff who will evaluate the situation with us, and we reconsult, of course, and then we have decisions to make.
Yeah, like what to do. Well, and we remember when Dr. Nielsen in 2009 had to give herself a biopsy, treat her own breast cancer. She found the lump. You know, you say go to the clinic to be treated by the doctor. She was the doctor, and she had two-way communication with other doctors who could help her while she treated herself. But just extraordinary what she had to do. And then when a manager suffered a stroke in 2011, there was some criticism of the NSF that she should have been evacuated sooner than the 2 months. So do you worry now that you might be overreacting to this situation and maybe putting the pilots and the sick person who's now going to fly out in jeopardy?
No, I want to say that each case presents its own dynamics. And with respect to this history of this, we've actually had two other cases where we've gone in with the Twin Otter to take care of medical situations, one in 2001 and one in 2003. In each case, there are a lot of consultations with medical experts and other experts. So we have to make a decision based on that. And we will. I can't comment any further because each case also has privacy concerns.
Right. Understandable. But it is very dangerous. And these people know this when they go there. What kind of work are they doing?
Well, we support very unique science at the South Pole Station. We have a range of activities going on that include everything from long-term monitoring the atmosphere to state-of-the-art telescopes that are looking at elements of the origin and nature of our universe. We have the world's unique neutrino detector there and many other activities going on.
Yeah. Well, it's just a reminder, Kelly, that you know, you don't have to go to outer space to have this kind of thrilling work and adventure, but also this kind of challenge, this kind of problem solving. You can do it right here on Earth. Kelly Faulkner, Division Director of Polar Programs at the National Science Foundation. They run the Amundsen Scott South Pole Station and are in the middle of a rescue right now of someone who works there who is seriously ill. Dr. Faulkner, best of luck.
Thank you. Thank you for the good wishes.
And if you want to track the planes on their emergency rescue mission, we will link you up at hereandnow.org.
Yeah, and Robin, I just checked the forecast at the South Pole today. It was a high of negative 53.
Okay.
So if you do the math, that's about 170 degrees colder there than it has been in much of the southwestern United States over the last couple of days. Meteorologists say it's the hottest start to a summer on record in Arizona, California, and New Mexico. Temperatures in some places have hit 120 degrees, and at least four people have died in Arizona. Crews fighting wildfires in all three states are having a harder time because of the weather. Iris Hermosillo is a meteorologist for ABC 15 in Phoenix, and she joins us now from her newsroom via Skype. Iris, welcome to you.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Sure, and look, it's always hot in Arizona in June, but this is sort of way beyond normal.
Yeah, this is unusually warm. We don't typically see temperatures this hot this early in the year, but yet here we are bracing for temperatures that are heating up to near 120. Yesterday, our hottest day so far of the year, we hit 118. That's the earliest we've ever been that hot. So very unusual temperatures. 118 was also a record-breaking temperature yesterday, topping the old record of 115 that stood from, you know, 1968. That's when the old record was.
Yeah, well, I mean, I remember on June 26th, 1990, it was the hottest day in recorded history in Arizona, which was 122 degrees. I was there. I was probably 9 years old, and I was playing a baseball game.
Oh.
And like looking back, it seems kind of strange that we were even doing that. So, you know, at what point these days does the city sort of shut down and stop operating?
You know what? It's dangerous temperatures. So we start heating up into the hundreds very early on in the day. So what we encourage people to is really to get outdoors early if they have to be outdoors. It's like a Midwest winter where you don't go outside because it's snowing, it's cold. It's kind of like that here, except that all of our windows are closed. You're doing your best to stay cool. You hope that the AC just keeps running. We've had a few power outages here this past weekend because of the heat. A lot of folks, you know, trying to stay cool, and those ACs just, you know, running, unfortunately.
Overtime,
yeah, that's for sure.
Well, some of the people who died, there's been about four of them at last count, they were actually overcome while they were hiking or they were biking outdoors. So how quickly does it become dangerous for someone who's outside in the sun?
It doesn't take long at all. I mean, it could just be a matter of minutes. A lot of times, if you're hiking and doing strenuous activity, cannot stress enough the importance of staying safe. Unfortunately, though, every single year, no matter how much we alert people to this dangerous heat coming, there are always stories like this. And it's very unfortunate. Like you said, four people died this weekend alone because they were either out of water or they were simply overcome by the heat. So I know our first responders were out and about this weekend trying to conduct a lot of these rescues And as much as we stress it, you really should not be outside under these conditions.
Mm, well, what else are people doing? I mean, at this time of year, it's very hard to be homeless. If you're elderly, yeah, it can be very dangerous. I hear there are efforts to get water out to elderly residents, maybe in more remote areas, or at least just to check on them to see if they're okay.
Absolutely. We stress that, you know, even if you have friends and neighbors that you know are elderly who might need a little bit of assistance, check on them. Make sure that their AC is working just fine. Also, the Salvation Army has set up cooling stations around town in an attempt to help folks who are homeless, who need to find water. So those cooling stations will be open through the middle of the week, which is when our excessive heat warning will expire Wednesday evening. So in hopes of trying to keep everybody safe and cool. This is our version of, you know, severe weather. Yes, we get storms and things like that, but these summer temperatures can be absolutely brutal, and we're all just crossing our fingers hoping for some monsoon rains sooner than later.
What do you do to stay cool?
So I went to the beach this past weekend. I did a little bit of an escape to try to get away from the heat. But when I'm here in town, like today, I will be sheltered inside my home with those blinds closed and a cold, ice cold drink. Just doing my best to stay cool.
Let me guess. You went to San Diego, which is a total retreat for Phoenix people.
It was a complete difference. But it was funny as we were driving back. I mean, in a matter of minutes, we went from the 90s to 105. Then we got to Yuma and it was 120. I mean, you could just feel the heat as you were even driving down the highway, getting back into the valley.
All right. Iris Hermosillo, a meteorologist for ABC 15 in Phoenix. You can hear her in the newsroom there, trying to stay cool during this heat wave. Iris, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Robin, what can I say? I'm happy to be in Boston at times like this.
But no, you're not. I mean, you're from Arizona. Explain to us, what is it like when you have heat like this? You've hated our when we sweat here. Right?
The worst thing is it's 5 a.m. in the morning. The sun is not even up, but the heat has been kind of held on in the concrete and the sidewalks and the buildings. It never cools down. And that's right. Why it's so dangerous.
Right.
Because you can't cool down.
And your shoes melt.
And your shoes do melt.
And judging by the tea leaves, it's not if Florida Senator Marco Rubio will run for re-election. It's which day this week he'll announce. He has till Friday to file. One Republican challenger dropped out last Friday. Another, Lieutenant Governor Carlos Lopez Cantera, says he will bow out if Rubio gets in and urged Rubio to do so. But how will Rubio then address all those pledges he made to never run again because nothing ever gets done in the Senate? Sergio Bustos is national political writer for the AP. He's based in Florida and joins us by Skype. Sergio, what's the buzz?
Well, the buzz is that he looks like Rubio's going to jump in.
Yeah, he told radio host Hugh Hewitt last week that he was at least thinking about it because of the Orlando shootings, of course, there in Florida. He wants to have a voice in fighting terrorism. Let's listen.
When it visits your home state, when it impacts the community, you know, well, it really gives you pause to think a little bit about your service to your country and where you can be most useful to your country.
Well, of course, and a Rubio victory would help Republicans keep the narrowly divided Senate next year by keeping a Senate seat Republican. But what's in it for Marco Rubio, who, you know, had a terrible attendance record? People say he hated his job.
Yeah, he says he never said he hated his job. That's what he claims. The problem he faces is he could lose twice in the same year, which would be a political embarrassment. You may recall that he went down in the Florida primary to Donald Trump. He lost 66 of 67 counties. The only county he won was his home county in Miami-Dade.
What about his competition? As I said, some people are dropping out to clear the way for him, but not everyone.
That's correct. In fact, there's a wealthy developer named Carlos Baruff, who's much like Donald Trump in running as an outsider candidate. And he could give Rubio a run for the primary. And then after that, he's going to face a very moderate Democrat, Congressman Patrick Murphy. He already took a swipe at Rubio over the weekend, accusing him of using the Orlando shooting as a, quote, excuse, unquote, for re-entering the race.
Now, well, you mentioned Patrick Murphy. He also has to win a primary. Who's he up against?
He's against Congressman Alan Grayson, a very controversial figure down here, who's facing some allegations of conflicts of interest because he's a former hedge fund manager. But the polls show Murphy's got a strong lead on him.
Well, President Obama has endorsed Congressman Patrick Murphy and recorded this new ad. It's targeted at African-American voters, but you might see there's a little zing at the end that could be at Rubio. Let's listen.
In Congress, I could always count on Patrick to have my back. He's been there for me when I needed him. Patrick is a strong progressive, standing up to the Tea Party obstructionists who try to turn back the clock on our progress.
And, of course, Marco Rubio was a Tea Party-backed candidate at one point. So, Sergio Bustos, we wait to see if he jumps back in the race. How do you think this will all be greeted by fellow politicians, you know, that he kind of dissed?
You know, it's a good question, because during the primary, when I went around interviewing primary voters, especially those who had backed him in 2010 as a Tea Party favorite, the word they kept using was betrayed. They felt Rubio had betrayed them on the immigration matter. And the really odd thing here, Robin, is that it's almost like Washington is telling Florida to vote for Rubio, and that's not going to go over well in the Sunshine State.
Well, we'll see. Sergio Bustos, national political writer for the AP. Thank you, Sergio.
Thank you.
You might remember, dear listener, that months ago we told you we'd tell you a story. It begins with a blissful sleep. But then, what? Wait, what is that? Is that someone sawing? Yes, and hammering, because this is total knee replacement surgery, or arthroplasty, usually because of severe arthritis or knee injury. I had it because I always do everything the former host of Here and Now does. Bruce Gellerman is now a reporter at WBUR. He had both his knees replaced and documented the entire process, and he joins us now to talk about that. Hi, Bruce.
Hi, Robin.
And what we refer to as the bee's knees.
But, you know, I got them done separately, right?
Right. And we're going to explain that. But first, this, you tell us, this is one of the most popular surgeries right now.
Oh, it's soaring. It's amazing. I mean, they're almost doing 1 million a year now. It's one of the most common surgeries. And 3 million surgeries in about 10 or 15 years. This is going to be the surgery, if you know.
Right. Like tonsils.
Exactly.
You know, for the same age group. You know, a lot of boomers getting the knees replaced. So, Bruce, no offense, but you look like a cowboy or an upside-down wishbone. You were so bow-legged.
I was, and I've always been bow-legged, but I was getting really bow-legged, and my knees were really hurting. So I went to the doc, and he took x-rays, and lo and behold, I was bone on bone, is what
right.
they say.
Well, this is what I learned, that bow-legged or knock-kneed, the opposite, are both signs of losing cartilage in your knees.
Right, exactly. My mother used to say if I had dated a woman who was knock-kneed, we'd spell ox.
So, and just have more on what you found out, because, you know, people might ask, well, how do I know? I have pain in my knees. How do you know you need the replacement?
That's a great question. How do you know? Because there's no big sign saying you need total knee replacement. So, you know, you endure it and you take aspirin and you endure it and you take ibuprofen and you endure it and you get your cortisone shots and you endure it until you can't endure it anymore. And for me, it came when I couldn't get on my bicycle anymore. Right. I couldn't ride.
I mean, you mentioned you have x-rays, you have MRIs when this happens. And you find out you're bone on bone, which means there's absolutely no cartilage
right,
in there.
Gone.
So that would make you a good candidate.
I was a great candidate. I mean, the doctor said to me, I'm amazed that you were able to walk into my office.
Yeah. Okay. So you walk in.
Hobbled.
There's like another cowboy joke there. You go through the surgery. First of all, were you afraid? This is losing a portion of your body.
Boy, you know, I never thought of it that way. I knew they were going to sew my legs in half, but I treated it like a story, and I researched the heck out of it, and I knew what to expect, or I thought I knew what to expect.
Right. We want to hear a little more of, you know, you post-op. But first of all, in your case, it was both knees. Right. So you had to – I mean, I remember when you had one done, and then you're kind of off kilter.
They don't like doing bilaterals. That's what it's called.
Because?
Because the complications are harder. You literally don't have a good leg to stand on afterwards.
Mm-hmm. So you had one leg done – and then the other.
Right, 6 weeks apart.
Let's listen to you as you come out after the second surgery.
Whoa. I'm in post-op. I don't remember very much after they knocked me out. But I can kind of wiggle my right toes. And I can lift up my left foot. Whoa. It's done. It's great. And I'm hungry. It's over.
But it's not.
You know, the pain endures. It's not like you're just done and you walk out of there.
Yeah, and it's the beginning of a long road of rehab. So tell us first, and people wonder about the pain. You have pain management.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
So, and talk about that, because I was very concerned, and I don't know if you were, about opioids.
Well, I was very concerned, and my goal in all of this was to be ready for the surgery, so I did what they call prehab, exercises before. Then I treated physical therapy as my religion.
It's full-time work all day, every day.
It is full-time work. Yeah, yeah. And I did three things religiously. I iced it. I used ice all the time. I got off the meds as soon as I possibly could. They really, really drugged me out. I did not like the way they made me feel. And I treated physical therapy
like a job, yeah.
A full-time and a half job.
Your orthopedic surgeon is a quite well-known and acclaimed one. He's now at Mount Auburn Hospital in Cambridge, Massachusetts, Robert Meagle. Let's listen to what he said after the surgery.
We could do the best knee replacement ever done. If the patient doesn't do their exercises, the results are terrible.
Terrible.
Boy, ain't that the truth. I mean, some people don't do well in the surgery. But they estimate between 5 and 30%. That's high. Don't do well in knee replacement because, you know, they go in, they're in a lot of pain, they haven't exercised in a long time. They may be overweight, they may have diabetes, they don't have a realistic level of expectation.
And the rehab is very difficult. You have to get yourself to the bathroom. You have to do all these things. There are people who are candidates for going into rehab facilities after surgery.
Some people do, and they come right out of the hospital and they go right into a rehab facility for a week or two. In my case, I didn't have to. I went home after 3 days in both cases, but I was flat on my back. And it's hard. You know, you're really humble.
Well, and people always say this about knee replacement. They're stunned because they think, oh, then you just recover. No, you have to make it bend and do the things you can't believe you're doing with it.
Yeah. I had visiting physical therapy, and you have to really look at it as a challenge.
Yeah. Okay. So you mentioned some people don't do well. You are out of pain now, right?
I have a little pain, I must say. You know, it's not total, but it's not the arthritic pain. I do steps, I can ride my bike, and I can do all those things. It's not that pain. I do have post-op pain. It feels a little tight around both knees, but it's less and less. Just this week, I was able to get on my knees and not feel any pain.
Are you praying, Bruce Gellerman? Praying. But actually, how long have you been since surgery?
It'll be almost a year.
So it takes a while.
Yeah, sure does.
It takes a while. Well, Bruce, there are other options. I know someone who had some cartilage in a painful knee, and the hospital he went to, they actually did some stem cell growth of that cartilage.
Yeah, and it's very experimental, really. The results are not well known at this point, and you have to pay for it privately, and that's very expensive. So, you know, they may be able to replace the cartilage, but if you've got damage to your bone like I did, you still got to get the knees replaced.
Yeah. And what about personalized or custom knees?
So they'll make personal knees for you, the exact fit. They'll use a 3D imaging system and build your knee from scratch. Whether they work any better, we're not sure at this point.
You mean from scratch as opposed to the titanium ball that they just have already made that becomes your knee?
That's right. And those are stock made and they fit you out for them while you're in surgery. You don't know which one you're getting, but they're pretty good at it at this point. There's a bunch of companies that do them. But, you know, this operation, they're perfecting. It's turned into a commodity. You know, hospitals are competing with each other for patients because it's a very expensive operation and, you know, it's they can turn them out.
Here in the Boston area, they're now – I mean, there's one hospital that only does this kind of orthopedic work. There's just about every hospital has a top doctor. But how do you know if you live in other – how do you know you have a good doctor?
Oh, that is such a great question. And what I was told, ask some nurses. They're the ones who see it day in and day out. Ask the doctor how often they've been doing this operation. How many did they do in the last year? That's a good indication. You want somebody who specializes in knees.
And we learned recently with a story here in Boston, you ask your doctor, he or she actually going to be the one doing it?
That's right. That's exactly true.
Yeah.
How are you doing?
Just great. Although they caution, they say, well, you probably shouldn't go running again. Some people, you know, feel they want to take that risk, but...
You were running down the hall before.
I don't tell. But that's the point. You have to sort of gauge everything you do, how you want to go forward. Rest of your life, dental work, you got to have antibiotics.
Right.
You don't want to have bacteria.
Yeah. You got to tell your dentist and all that kind of stuff. But, you know, my knees are good, they say, for about 20 years. That's good for me. Let me show you something.
Okay.
Robert. Okay.
Right.
Come on.
All right. I'm watching. He's standing up, ladies and gentlemen.
What do you think?
Oh, my God.
Straight.
Straight-legged Bruce. Something. Bruce Gellerman, senior correspondent for our mothership, WBUR, and founder of Here and Now. Bruce, thanks so much.
You're very welcome.
Of course, there are risks with total knee replacement of blood clots, infections. There are always complications from anesthesia and surgery. Cysts creating stiffness behind the knees. You may need a manipulation if you can't get your knee to bend in physical therapy. Yes, I'm talking to you, Paul. I was told my knee would set off alarms at airport security. It does not. And for a very small fraction, it may not work. You may have pain. But I know a double knee replacement who's playing Masters tennis, although it's advised you not run and risk wearing your new knee down. We'll see how that goes. Anyway, consult with your doctor, of course. It's Here and Now.
Dory?
Dory!
Dory!
I remembered something. That's not possible. Is it?
Okay. Finding it like Dory, starring the voice of Ellen DeGeneres, took in a record $136 million over the weekend. It was the most successful launch for an animated film in U.S. box office history. Finding Dory, of course, is also a sequel to the 2003 film Finding Nemo. And you might have noticed it's one of many sequels this year. As Derek Thompson writes in The Atlantic, all this could have some repercussions for the film industry in the long run. Derek joins us from New York. Derek, it's good to have you back.
Good to be here.
Okay, it kind of feels like we're at peak sequel right now. What's going on?
Well, this story really starts in the 1950s. Movies used to be the third biggest retail category in the U.S. People were buying 35 movie tickets a year as late as the 40s or 50s. And then comes along this new technology called the television. And after the television, people stopped going to the movies so much. Tickets bought per American per year fell from about 35 to about 4 in the early 1970s. And so since then, movie studios have been cycling through all of these strategies trying to figure out how do we mitigate the risk of creating this enormous, expensive product and try to get people to buy tickets to it. And the most recent strategy that at least seems to be working, seems to have been working, is this sequel strategy. You roll out iteration after iteration of the same handful of franchises in the hopes that people will want to see the sort of new chapter of their favorite story.
Well, you write that 20 years ago, that none of the top 10 films were sequels or superhero films. Instead, people were watching things like this.
A historic and unprecedented event is occurring. The question of whether or not we are alone in the universe has been answered.
Okay, that was Independence Day. Will Smith, of course, I'm having a flashback to high school here about an alien attack on Earth. Now, there is an Independence Day sequel coming out this week. You know, do people like these? Do they work?
Yes, they do work. There has been a lot of ink spilled on this concept that sequels have stopped working because a handful of sequels have failed so far this year. But let's be clear. To the extent that Hollywood knows what it's doing, sequels are the only thing that are working. In 2015, 6 out of the top 10 and 11 out of the top 20 films were sequels. This year, it's the exact same story. 6 out of the top 10, 11 out of the top 20 films are sequels. And that was a stat that I pulled out before Finding Dory became the biggest opening in Pixar history. So it is very difficult to make a product that people want in the level of millions. And it does still seem that to the extent that Hollywood knows what people want, that thing is sequels.
A sequel or superhero movies. You've got Batman versus Superman, Dawn of Justice, which is out now.
I'm getting slow in my old age, Alfred.
Even you got too old to die young.
Not for lack of trying.
Okay, so if you're a superhero fan, this movie might work for you. But do you think there is a problem in the long run? If you're leaning too much to these sequels or to the superhero themes, does that hurt the movie industry?
Yes, it absolutely does hurt the movie industry, but the way that it hurts the movie industry, I think, is a little bit complicated. I think what's happened is that a lot of studios have overlearned the lesson that sequels work, and as a result, they're trying to sequelize essentially every moderately successful movie. You have sequels for Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles and Zoolander and a Snow White sequel without Snow White and a follow-up to the Seth Rogen comedy Neighbors. You have all of these movies that 20 years ago, studios would have just let them be sort of successful single children, and now they're trying to pump out a bunch of siblings that simply shouldn't be there.
Right. You
and
might so, ask, like, what's the reason to have a Zoolander follow-up, right?
And there is no reason other than the fact that these studios don't know what else is going to be successful. Huh. You have all of these auteurs of original stories that have moved to the vast expanse of television, leaving the sort of list of movie titles essentially it's laden with sequels, reboots, and adaptations.
Well, that's got to be tough if I'm a filmmaker and I don't want to be making a sequel or a movie about superheroes. Or, you know, it's got to be tough for people going to the movies who don't want to watch that.
And what you're seeing right here, and this is what I wrote for The Atlantic last week, is that Hollywood now has this huge millennial problem. Mm. The people most likely to buy tickets in the U.S. today are those between about 18 and 39. That is the key demographic. And it turns out that this key, most important demographic is also abandoning movies faster than any other group. So it's interesting. They're going to all of these other various size screens. They're staying home with their enormous LCD, or they're happy looking at Snapchat and YouTube on their little mobile device. Mm. They're doing anything except going to the movies at the same rate that they used to. And as a result, I think Hollywood worries that it's in trouble and is spending even more money on these sequels, which holds them up to essentially even larger potentials for failure. The flops are getting bigger, yeah, just as the hits are getting bigger as well.
Even talk of trying to let millennials or people text on their cell phones during a movie. Derek Thompson is senior editor at The Atlantic. Thanks very much for speaking with
us. Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.